Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. We begin today's show by listening to my interview with former NASA climatologist James Hansen. For years, he's been sounding the alarm about the dangers of climate change. His 1988 congressional testimony helped to raise awareness about the harmful effects of greenhouse gas emissions. He recently made an appearance at the UN Climate Change Summit, declaring that we are on the wrong track in combating the effects of global warming. He joined me in 2010 following the publication of his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, which discussed his turn from scientist to activist. We began by talking about his prediction of a catastrophic weather event. Let's listen. From your perspective, what does that catastrophe look like?
Well, you know, I should say, first of all, I know it's difficult for people to recognize that we are in a crisis point, but in fact we are. And the reason that can be, we don't see that much happening. If we stick our head out the window, the weather, you know, looks pretty much like normal. But because of the inertia that the climate system has, the ocean being 4 kilometers deep and the ice sheets being 2 or 3 kilometers thick, it takes this system a long time to start responding to the forces that are applied to it. And humans have become the biggest forcing. And the system is beginning to respond. And the danger is that we will push it far enough that it will pass tipping points where processes begin to occur under the dynamics of the system and become out of our control. You know, a simple example is the ice sheets. If an ice sheet begins to disintegrate, slide down a slope to the ocean, then it's too late. You can't tie a rope around it. It's a huge thing, 2 or 3 kilometers thick.
Perhaps this is the catastrophe that you're alluding to, an ice-free world. What would that look like?
Well, sea level would be 250 feet higher.
Meaning, and that would essentially cover most of the landmass, would it not?
No, not most of the landmass, but all of the coastal cities for sure. A large fraction of the people on the planet live along coastlines. But that would take time to get to that point. Once the ice sheets begin to disintegrate, we will get continual changes for the next few centuries. And so we don't want to get to that point. And what was frustrating for me was the fact that As we realized, and it's not just me, the scientific community realizes the situation that we've got ourselves in. The frustrating thing is that the actions that are needed to solve the problem actually make sense for other reasons. For solving our fossil fuel addiction and making a cleaner atmosphere and cleaner waters, we need to phase off the fossil fuels. Before they run out, we're going to have to leave some of the coal in the ground and the unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands. If we would do that, we could stabilize the climate over the next several decades. But we have to begin to move rapidly off of our fossil fuel addiction.
And not to be too obsessed with this looming catastrophe as you describe it, though, but from your perspective, how much of a time frame do we have in order in which we must act from your perspective?
Well, we need to get started in the next few years. You know, in 2005, I said we had 10 years to get off of the path of increasing emissions onto one where we're decreasing the emissions. And so far, we haven't done that. The emissions have continued to increase. So we really have to get some agreements for changes within the next few years, or our children and grandchildren will suffer the consequences.
Let me quote something. This is actually from the New York Times, but you made this reference to the National Research Council, and this is, according to the Times, an arm of the National Academy of Sciences, came out with a report, and again, just going back to the Times, in its most comprehensive study so far, the nation's leading scientific body declared that climate change is a reality and is driven mostly by human activity, chiefly the burning of fossil fuels and deforestation. And I know we've heard this these pronouncements before, but the significance of this report, these findings to you?
Well, I had been saying the last several years that the president should ask the Academy for a clear statement because, you know, the politics is not allowing action now. there's the pretense that we don't understand the matter. That's not true. We understand it. Sure, there are a lot of details, which how soon ice sheets will disintegrate and how rapidly and how soon a species will be wiped off the planet. There are a lot of timing details that are uncertain, but the overall story is very clear. And so that gives the politicians the grounds now for action. There's really no basis for continuing to say we don't know for sure.
You write in your book that cheap fossil fuels are the problem, that they have driven climate change, global warming, and that fossil fuels has really created this false economy. Can you expand on that?
Well, it's not a false economy. Fossil fuels have been extremely beneficial. They've been the source of our improving standards of living over, you know, the last century since we began to use them. But unfortunately, they're very remarkable, the way that energy, that nature has concentrated energy in oil, gas, and coal is remarkable. You can push a vehicle for many tens of miles on a small amount of fuel. But unfortunately, we can't continue to burn all of the fossil fuels, or we will make the planet look as it did when that carbon was in the atmosphere earlier in the Earth's history. And that was a very different planet with no ice on the planet, sea level 250 meters higher. And, of course, we also know that warming of that magnitude would drive a large fraction of the species on the planet to extinction because they can only live within certain climate zones. So there are a lot of reasons why we need to stabilize climate.
Is coal the biggest threat?
Coal is the biggest threat at this time. It's now, again, become the major source of carbon dioxide. We're going to run out of oil and gas, at least the easily mineable oil and gas. And our energy infrastructure is so set up to use those that we have to expect that the big pools of oil and gas will be used. They're owned by Russia and Saudi Arabia and countries that, you know, you can't prevent them from selling them, and the world economy needs them on the short run. But we've got to phase off them and onto clean energy sources over the next few decades. And coal is much bigger source and potentially much bigger. We're just going to have to leave most of the remaining coal in the ground, and the governments don't yet recognize that.
Well, I'm looking actually at a letter that you and your wife sent to Michelle and Barack Obama. This was back in December 2008, where you do talk about coal-fired power plants with carbon capture and sequestration as at least one potential solution to the problem of greenhouse gas emissions. But sounds like you're saying now that we either don't have the technology or we don't have the time to make that happen.
Well, I think you have to allow that and other solutions compete. And by that I mean energy efficiency, renewable energy like solar and wind and nuclear power and carbon capture compete. And I think in that competition, it's clear that carbon capture is not, clean coal is not going to be the winner. But, you know, you can allow that as an option, but what they've been doing so far is using it as an excuse to keep burning dirty coal while they pretend that they were working on clean coal. During the entire 8 years of the Bush administration, they had a clean coal project, which was just mostly pushing papers. There was no real progress on that. And they terminated it during the last year of the Bush administration.
I think I can hear it in your voice, but just how frustrated are you with our political system?
Well, it's very frustrating because the solutions actually make sense for other reasons. But there is some basis for optimism.
As you say, there are some reasons for optimism, and the Chinese are developing some interesting energy technologies, including nuclear power. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, I was surprised to learn that you are a supporter of what you describe as fourth-generation nuclear power. First of all, how is that different from the first generation of nuclear power?
The current generation light water reactors burn less than 1% of the energy in the nuclear fuel. The other 99-plus percent is in a waste pile that has half-life of 10 to 100,000 years. So it's a tremendous problem. The fourth generation, so-called fast reactors, allow the neutrons to go fast, and they can burn more than 99% of the energy in the nuclear fuel and leave a waste that is much smaller in volume and has a half-life of only decades rather than thousands of years. And the other merit of fourth generation is that it can burn nuclear waste from the existing light water reactors. We have enough material to power these fast reactors for 700 years without mining any more uranium.
And they're safe from what you know?
Yeah, they can be much safer than the past generations of nuclear power plants. And by the way, you should recognize, though, that the current generation of nuclear power is the best safety record of all the major industries in the country. If you compare that to the record of coal, which is killing 100,000 people per year around the world.
And this is just from inhaling?
From air and water pollution. Coal is extremely dirty. That's the source of the mercury that you hear about, that's accumulated in the oceans, and just the air pollution itself and the water pollution. But nuclear, you know, to people is a little scary because they don't understand it as well as they understand these black rocks of coal. But in fact, the nuclear already is much safer, and it can be made still safer.
That was my 2010 interview with former NASA climatologist James Hansen. He had joined me to discuss his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. He recently made an appearance at the UN Climate Change Summit. You're listening to Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from our break, we'll hear from another environmental activist, the late Wangari Maathai. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We just heard from climatologist James Hansen, whose research led him to become an environmental activist. Now let's meet another pioneer in combating climate change, the late Wangari Maathai of Kenya. She won a Nobel Peace Prize for founding the Greenbelt Movement, an environmental conservation organization responsible for combating deforestation. She joined me in 2006 to discuss her memoir, Unbowed. Let's take a listen. You were born in colonial Kenya. This is back in 1940. And you describe growing up in the central highlands of Kenya. And it sounded like the most sort of beautiful, green, lush, almost like a paradise part of Kenya.
Indeed. When I was growing up and comparing it, especially with what I see today, it was pristine environment, most beautiful, clean and healthy. And not surprisingly, the people were also very healthy, well-fed. Children were well-fed. The water was so clean that I would fetch water from the river and bring it home, and we would drink it. We didn't even have to boil it. It was so clean. and the rivers were flowing very fast. They were, I talk about roaring rivers because we are on the hills, and roaring clean rivers are full of fish. And so for me, I describe that especially to them, to counteract with what happened shortly after in the name of development.
Well, what did you see? And was it a matter of chopping down trees in order to clear land for either development, maybe even more agriculture?
Several issues that I would like to describe. One is the fact that just about that time, the British administration, which was in charge at that time, decided that in order to support the building and the paper industry and the furniture industry that was emerging in the new colony, they should bring in trees that were fast growing, and of course which would be very useful to these industries. And this was mainly the pines from the Northern Hemisphere. They also, you will remember, this was a time of the steam engine, and they wanted to bring in trees that grow fast in order to provide the wood to burn and drive the engines, but also to dry up a lot of the land that they wanted to exploit commercially. And they brought eucalyptus from Australia. Now, these two species of trees did very well in our mountains, but it was at the expense of the indigenous ecosystem. And that eventually is the reason why the water pattern went down, the rivers lost their volumes, and some of the streams dried up. The other was the introduction of cash crops, especially tea and coffee. Now, for these trees to thrive, they needed to be planted in as a monoculture, and especially the tea had to be grown in very steep slopes, on very steep slopes. And so when this land was cleared and was exposed, the soil was exposed, and at the same time the mountains were being deforested, environmental degradation started to take place in a very big way. But unfortunately, many people did not see it because they were seeing development, and they were seeing as if this is necessary sacrifices for development. But today, of course, we know it could have been done without so much destruction.
So when you go back to Central Highlands of Kenya, where you grew up, how different does it look?
Now, as I say, the rivers, some rivers have dried up. Others have become streams. Yet in my childhood, they were rolling rivers. There is no more the vegetation, the green vegetation that I speak about. And even the little stream that I talk about, it's no longer the stream, a stream that I can go there and my children or my grandchildren to play with frog eggs the way I used to. And the forests are very depleted, and many of the fights, when one reads the book, was to try to draw attention to the fact that we need to not only remove these exotic plantations outside the forest, but allow the forest to go back to its ecological system, to go back to the traditional indigenous forest, so that the rivers can flow again and the rainfall can be regular again. Of course, what we are observing may very well be part of the bigger picture of global warming. And those of you who may have seen the film by the former Vice President Al Gore,
An Inconvenient Truth,
you will have seen that some of the mountains, like Mount Kenya and Mount Kilimanjaro, and in other places like the polar caps, we are losing the ice and the water systems that is responsible for our fresh water and our rainfall patterns, and therefore all these issues are exacerbating. So part of what I see, I am quite sure, is partly due to the destruction locally, but it is also probably partly due to the global impact of the global warming.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the kind of education you got, because it was unusual at that time in Kenya in the 40s and 50s for a girl to become as educated as you did, and you have a PhD. You were educated in college and graduate school in the United States. Who in your family was supportive of an educated daughter?
Well, I must give this credit to my mother and my brother. My elder brother asked my mother, "Why doesn't Tuangale go to school with us?"
An innocent question.
Yeah. And my mother said, "Well, I don't see why she cannot go to school." I am so grateful for my mother for making that decision. Had it not been for my mother, I'm sure I would have been a very different person. So I'm so grateful for her courage in making that decision. And again, my family decided to let me go to high school. When I was finishing high school around 1960, it was just about the time when Senator Kennedy was also planning to become the next president of the United States. And he and some politicians around him made decisions that changed my life.
And this was the Kennedy airlift.
The Kennedy airlift.
And you were one of those students airlifted to the United
States.
That's
right. And that was really a momentous decision. Again, a decision being made by those who were in a position to make a decision to help African students come to America, go to colleges. And that indeed made my life. If I had not come to America, I would not have been the person I have become.
Will you even describe when there was the Mau Mau rebellion back in the 1950s that it was, and this was a rebellion against British rule, that some families were split over that. Some supported the Mau Mau and some were critics of the Mau Mau.
Yeah, and indeed that's another very important political split that we still have. Are suffering from. In fact, we are still having to deal with that issue because some of us, we are trained to believe that the Mau Mau were a terrorist group. They should not be fighting. They were wrong. They were committing sins. And so I describe a scene where a sister comes and talk to us in the middle of the night, and we go on our knees and we are praying the rosary, and we are praying that the Mau Mau be caught by the British. Yet, in retrospect, these were freedom fighters. They were trying to free us from the colonial rule of the British. And just like we were split right there, in the countryside, of course, there were those who understood that it was important for people to be free on their land, not to be oppressed, not to be exploited. And of course, there were those who were indoctrinated to believe that the British were right, that being a colonial power, they were powerful, we ought to have subdued ourselves and to accept their power. That is a major split, a political split that, as I say, is still haunting us.
Was there a moment at which you thought, planting trees, you know, this deceptively simple act could lead to economic development, it could lead to even gender equality?
When I started, those of you who made it the book, you'll see that I really wasn't starting a movement. I was starting an initiative to respond to the felt needs of women who were discussing with us at the National Council of Women of Kenya on how women can help themselves. As we prepared to go to Mexico in 1975, when we declared the very first women decade. But eventually what happened is that, and I like to use the onion. When you are looking at the onion and you want to know what is, you remove the first layer and then you discover there is another layer. And you remove the next layer and you discover the other layer. What I found out is that what the women we are talking about in 1973-74 were as a problem with energy, which is mainly firewood, problem with the clean drinking water, food, or even income. These were symptoms, and I gradually came to know and to realize that they are symptoms, and those are usually the ones that are glaring at us. But the cause of those symptoms or the problems are usually hidden deep inside that onion, and you have to keep peeling off so as to reach the cause, the root cause of the problem. And that's what I eventually discovered, and so there was need to get to governance issues, to policy issues. There was need to address human rights issues because they were all interconnected. And when they are not dealt with, they eventually lead to the problems that we then confront in society.
And let me just quote something from your book. You write, as the Greenbelt movement developed, I became convinced that we needed to identify the roots of the disempowerment that plagued the Kenyan people. We had to understand why we were losing firewood, why there was malnutrition, scarcity of clean water, topsoil loss, and erratic rains, why people could not pay school fees, and why the infrastructure was falling apart, why we were robbing ourselves of a future.
Precisely. But now, realizing that is a very, very important issue. And that's what the Norwegian Nobel Committee was talking about when they said that we had approached development holistically. Mm. Holistically. That word became very, very important because we were not just dealing with the symptoms. We went to the root cause of the problems.
And you invested in women. Interestingly.
And we invested in women. And one reason why I invested in women is because when you read the book, you see that we started the discussion under the umbrella of the National Council of Women of Kenya. But in our part of the world, those who know East Africa, it is the women who work on the land. So it was only natural that we should talk to the women. And they responded very positively because they were responding because this was going to address their felt needs that they had articulated. But I should also mention that in the course of time, the men also joined in, mostly planting trees in order to improve the economic value of their land, which was just fine if that's what will make the men work. So let it be.
Is it harder? Are you saying it's harder to get men to do
it's
this kind of work?
It's much harder to make the men work because they're not the ones that are confronted or that have to deal with environmental degradation. Hmm. Because when there is environmental degradation and there is no water, it's the women who have to go and look for it. Firewood, it's the women who have to go for it. Food, it's the women who have to worry about it. Sometimes men will run away or go away to distant towns and cities looking for jobs. But for women, they are stuck there and have to deal with the harshness of the environment. And so they are much more willing to respond to those issues when you tell them that there is something we can do. They are much more willing. But for the men, you have almost to have an economic value so that they respond.
You led a demonstration in Uhuru Park in Nairobi. The government wanted to build, a high-rise, I guess, on the park.
Yeah, some 62-story skyscraper.
And you and others didn't want this to happen. You protested against it. Why was that so important, especially within a city?
There were several reasons, actually, why that was a very unwise decision. One is because that open space is very necessary for people living in Nairobi. Every city needs open space. And especially because you have so many cars, you have a lot of pollution in cities, you need trees and green vegetation to fix the greenhouse gases that come out of the factories and cars. And just an open space for people to go and lie down and enjoy the sun or enjoy the silence. So that was very important. The second reason why it was not it was bad is those were the times when we were talking about the fact that many leaders in Africa were borrowing money and putting up what we were calling white elephants in Africa and putting people into debt. And let alone, you remember, we campaigned against these huge debts which were impoverishing the ordinary people, and yet it was the leaders who were borrowing this money. So at that time, we were also questioning the wisdom of putting a 62-story skyscraper in the middle of Nairobi where we didn't even have enough water to go to the second floor. Mm. What were we doing with the 62 floors?
Can you have, though, economic development and conservation?
Definitely you can. I think that quite often that question is asked. But we do not have to sacrifice the quality of our life for development. Development is supposed to improve our quality of life. And we can indeed develop without destroying our environment. And let me just give one example. Many people know, especially people who know Kenya, know that the Aberdare Mountain, which is on the eastern side of the Great Rift Valley, about 20 miles from Nairobi, on the southern end, It's a very, very important mountain because about 3 million people or so live around this mountain and benefit from the waters and the rainfall that comes from these mountains. Nairobi itself is the capital of Kenya, and it gets 100% of its water from this mountain. Yet this is one of the mountains where we had gone in and we had clear-cut large parts of the forest to replace it, to replace the indigenous forest with commercial plantations. And we kept saying that we must remove commercial plantations from these forests so that the forest will continue to be a catchment area for water and also a site for biological diversity protection. Now, we do not have to destroy that forest for us to develop, because without that forest, we cannot develop. It will be a part-time apparent development, but in short term, we shall have to move Nairobi, because you can't be in Nairobi if you don't have water.
Again, that was my conversation with environmental conservation activist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai, recorded in 2006. She died 5 years later from complications of ovarian cancer. This is Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my conversation with legendary television producer Norman Lear. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Over the past year, there have been many incidents that have illuminated the racial divide in this country. There are many ways to shed light on race relations, including satire and comedy. Television producer Norman Lear took this approach when he created the series All in the Family. The show's protagonist, Archie Bunker, personified the discomfort that many aging whites felt in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement. Lear joined us last year to discuss his memoir titled Even This I Get to Experience. It was recently announced that a documentary based on his life will be released next year on PBS called American Masters, Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You. Let's take a listen to my conversation with Norman Lear. Your father, Herman, who called
Herman
him
King, Herman K.
Herman K, like King Lear, right?
Yes, everybody called him H.K.
H.K. I mean, he was, how would you describe your dad?
He was, the word that rushes to mind and I can't give up is he was a rascal. But within his rascaldom, to coin a phrase, he cheated, he stole. He went to prison because he stole. It's very hard for me to say all that, but he was a liar and a cheat and with a glorious zest for life, and the umbrella tag for him in my heart and mind is he was a rascal.
A rascal, which is, I mean, a rascal is more benign, shall we say, than a liar and a cheat.
And that's exactly why my heart chooses it.
Well, as you said, you were, about 9 years old, and your dad goes to prison for 3 years.
I was 9 years old. He was going. He was flying. Nobody flew then except Lindy. He was flying to Oklahoma, some transaction taking place there, and he was going to bring me back a 10-gallon hat, just like my favorite cowboy hero Ken Maynard wore. And he was arrested instead. as he stepped off the plane coming back from Tulsa, he didn't have a hat with him. And that night, that very night, the papers were strewn around the house, and he was on the front page with his own hat covering his face as he was manacled to a detective. And my mother was selling the furniture. We were moving. I mean, it just was a 9-year-old nightmare.
Yeah, and you even have a scene where you're watching this, and one of your relatives says, "Now you're the man of the house, but
yeah,
don't cry."
I love that. I think I say in the book that's where I thought I began to understand the foolishness of the human condition. That this guy puts his hand. I mean, I'm holding a cloth. I was supposed to go to camp in a few weeks. So my mother had this Norman M. Lear, Norman M. Lear, Norman M. Lear that she was going to sew into my clothing. When I went away, to camp, and this fool in that condition, this kid in that condition, he puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "You're the man in the house now." Yeah. I wanted to whip him.
Yeah. You went to live with relatives for a couple of years. I mean, it sounds like the family kind of scattered until your dad came back home from prison.
Yes, I lived with an uncle, then finally with my grandparents, my mother's parents.
You describe meeting your father. I guess you're on a train. He gets back, and he says, "You know, for your bar mitzvah, I'm going to take you and the family. We're going to go around the world." Did he live? I mean, did he, when he said something, did he was he just fantasizing this life for his family?
I love that you singled that out because it's such a key to him. We're sitting on the train. He sits with my mother for a while. I'm with my sister. Then we switch around. He's finally sitting with me. And we're talking about this, that, or the other thing. And then suddenly he says, "You're going to be bar mitzvah next year. For your bar mitzvah, I'm going to take you and your mother and your sister for a trip around the world. We'll be gone a year." And that was my mantra.
Yeah. Did you believe him?
I believed him totally. Mm-hmm. I believed him. The situation was that we were going to New York to live with other people until he found a job and could afford his own apartment. And in that condition, the man says, and I believe he believed, that in a year we're going to take a trip around the world and we'll be gone a year.
Of course it didn't happen.
Of course it didn't
happen.
It was the middle of the Depression. A year later, he was as broke as he was when he got out of prison.
You also say an interesting thing about him is that he, as you said, he was had a big personality, but he treated everybody the same, which I thought was
interesting. Oh, you really read the book.
I really read the book. No, I did. But I found, and I'm always interested in where people came from and their parents and their growing up and their childhood and families. But the idea, especially if you're the child of someone who treats everybody the same, you kind of feel like you're not special.
Yeah, he had no sense that this fellow might be smarter than him in any way, or somebody else may be weaker and needs to be tended to a little differently. One of my favorite stories is a friend graduates from accountancy school and opens an office in accounting. And my father, whose hat, the brim of whose hat was his office, you know, he had slips of paper in the hat band. That was kind of his desk in his office. He's arguing about some very serious matter having to do with accounting with a young man, brilliant young man, just out of college with his accounting degree.
That was your dad.
That was my dad.
To go on, you call your mom, Jeanette, a world-class narcissist.
She was the best.
At being a narcissist?
The best narcissist in the history of narcissism.
Really? Her picture's in the encyclopedia?
Yes, you'll find her everywhere. But a lot of people had this mother, I have since learned.
How did her narcissism express itself? I mean, there's so many anecdotes in here of her.
Well, I was always 9 years old. When she was talking about me, I never grew older than when we lived in New York up to the age my father went away. And she would talk about the Norman who used to fall down the stairs to get a laugh. And maybe I did that once, but she held on to that. She never talked about the Norman who did this television show or that television show. I was always a kid as she described loving me. She described loving me. Never told me to my face.
Do you think she
when
was
jealous? After my first big success, huge success, was the Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis Colgate Comedy Hour. The four of us kind of went into television together. They, the stars, we, the writers. And I called her as the credits were rolling and the show wasn't quite over. I'm on the phone in a phone booth off stage, calling my mother at 68 Woodstock Street, Hartford. And the first question, I expect her to burst out with something. And the first thing she says is, "How did it go, darling?" Mm. And when I said, "But didn't you say?" "Of course." "Did the boys like it?" Meaning Dean and Cherry.
Not you.
It. I don't know if ever in that conversation she said, "I laughed."
Do you feel, I mean, it's interesting, as you said, you were 68. Knowing this, your mother, the way you did, but hoping that this might be the time that she would recognize you, acknowledge you.
When the Hall of Fame story?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. A good friend who was running the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences called me early on a Sunday morning to tell me they had met on Saturday and the Academy was going to start a Hall of Fame. And they had decided on the first inductees. And they were going to be the guy who invented CBS, the guy who invented NBC, the best correspondent in the history of television, Edward R. Murrow, Patty Chayefsky, the best writer, wow. Lucille Ball, Milton Berle, and you, Norman. I was going to be in that pantheon. I called my mother as quickly as I could in Bridgeport. By then, she had remarried and my father had passed. And I told her, and she said, "Listen, if that's what they want to do, who am I to say?"
Oh, gosh. Were you a funny kid?
My mother tells me I was funny falling downstairs.
But besides that?
Besides that, when I got to high school, I wrote the humor column, Notes to You from King Lear.
I do want to jump forward to your time in television, and you were interested in this British comedy, Till Death Do Us Part, the idea of turning that into a show for Americans.
It was introduced to me by a woman by the name of Beryl Virtue. She was an agent at the time, I think still functioning in London. I had called her because I read about this show, A Simple Line in TV Guide.
About a father and a son.
About a father and son who had the relationship that Archie and that was me. That was my father. I was the laziest white kid he ever met.
And that's what your father would say to you,
would
right?
My father, yeah. And when I would bawl him out for putting a race of people down to call me lazy, it wasn't what he was doing, and I was the dumbest white kid he ever met.
So that was the sort of genesis then of
yeah, we,
of all
we
the
argued
family.
About everything. And as soon as I heard about, read about this, I thought, how did I not think of this before?
So how did you, I know it was a struggle to get it on TV, to say the least.
To say the least. It took three, I made it originally for ABC. There were only three networks at the time. ABC bought it originally. Made the same script exactly that I made 3 years plus some months later. Didn't change a word because I used to say, we're going to jump into the water. You can't get wetter than wet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get wet with Archie. We're going to know 360 degrees of the man. So it was the same script. They wouldn't make it the first year. They had the right to pick it up for a year.
This is ABC.
ABC, and make it again. And so I did it twice before they lost it. And then somebody, Robert Wood, came on as a new president of CBS. He looked at the show and wanted it.
And as you say, Archie, in a sense, is it an homage to your father? I mean, is it a sort of a tribute to your dad? Or it's taking your father and putting him out there for us to look at?
My father was a kickoff. Then the game played out 4 quarters, and Archie was all 4 quarters, not just the kickoff.
How did you see Archie Bunker?
I saw Archie Bunker as afraid of tomorrow, afraid of what tomorrow would bring, afraid of progress. so long as he was doing well, he was holding on and clutching the present, not moving into the future. In a way, I guess that was my, I'm thinking this perhaps for the first time, that was my dad too. What he thought of himself in the moment he thought it represented, he never learned anything. Mm. He never moved forward. That was it.
Do you think of him as a racist?
Yes, he was, but I look for reasons behind that. And there were other things that were playing into it, like the fear of tomorrow.
Right.
What? Black people moving next door? I don't know black people. I've never been with black people. They're not. That's the way the culture has treated my part of the city and black people.
You write in this book about the difficulties you had with Carol O'Connor, who played Archie Bunker, and perhaps even the difficulties he had with the scripts, with the storylines, with the language. I mean, it seemed like it was just a constant battle with him over his part.
Yes. I think it stemmed for two reasons. One, a lot, he's not the only actor that was fearful getting before representing something for a live audience. And what he represented was 180 degrees from the Irish intellect that Carol O'Connor was. So all of that, plus the fact that he was playing a bigot, which he wished to play. He had no problem playing. But he had to have some sense of responsibility, you know. Anyway, there was enough reason for him to be concerned about what he was doing, legitimately. But that I couldn't let that concern make the decisions when there was disagreement. He helped every scene he ever played. He was the best writer for the dialogue we could imagine, because the way things poured out of his face was better than anything, the dialogue we wrote.
But do you think that comedy or satire allows either writers or perhaps an audience to think about these important issues that you care so much about, but you can do it and sort of laugh and not feel somehow assaulted by a message?
No, I think that's exactly right. There were a few people that were assaulted by the message. The people, the best story I have to illustrate that was when, before the show went on the air, when they did focus groups. And I would stand in the other opposite side of a glass, and I would watch 30, 40 people looking at the pilot. And, you know, when people laugh together, really from the gut, they have a way of rising up an inch out of their chair and moving forward. So you see a wave. I would see a wave, and I would look at the dial, because they were turning a dial to say they liked it or hated it. And they turned it, negatively. They didn't like it, but they're roaring with laughter, which means they didn't want to be judging whether it was right or wrong for Archie to say the things he was saying. They wanted to be on record saying wrong, but they were reacting. You know, that's the answer to that question the best way I can put it.
That was my conversation with Norman Lear, who joined me last year to discuss his memoir, Even This I Get to Experience. A documentary about his life is set to premiere at Sundance next year. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show with the help of our intern, Diana Allen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific weekend.